You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything, available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Monster House presents.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Monster Talk listeners may be aware that my production company, Monster House, also produces a show called In Research Of. In that show, I'm joined by archaeologist Dr. Jeb Card as we review episodes of the 1970s and 80s series that explored many topics of interest to Monster Talk listeners. Of course, I'm talking about In Search Of. Season 4 of In Search Of included an episode that looked into the mystery of the Shroud of Turin. Was the Shroud a miraculous relic that once wrapped the body of Jesus and was infused with a faint image of his body in repose? Or was it, as scientists and historians have suggested, a 14th century fraud that had been identified as such contemporaneous to its first known appearance in history? That episode included an appearance by a young investigator named Joe Nickel, and we now know him as the venerable Dean of Scientific Paranormal Investigation, but his appearance there gave us a rare opportunity to talk to someone about In Search Of who had actually been on the show. What follows is a bonus episode from In Research Of that I'm cross-posting here because I think it'll be of interest to all our Monster House family. If you haven't checked out In Research Of, you can find it at Patreon, and you can also find links to the series in our show notes. Also, I'm quite far along with Joe's next book coming out, so stay tuned for announcements when his latest volume, The Science of Monsters, will be released into the book reading world, early in 2024, hopefully. Alrighty, without further ado, let's go hear about what it was like to be on the TV show In Search Of from investigator and author, Dr. Joe Nickel.
Monster Talk.
Today we're interviewing Dr. Joe Nickel, who listeners just saw and or heard from in our coverage of Season 4 of In Search Of, Episode 7, In Search of the Shroud of Turin. Joe is a researcher and a writer, and in the course of that work, he has familiarized himself with scores of skills and occupations, which he refers to on his website as personas. And you should do yourself a favor and check out joenickel.com with two L's. And you can see the many interesting entries from Joe's colorful life, as well as links to his books and writings. And today we're having Joe on for a special bonus episode because he is the first person that we've been able to track down from the original In Search Of series who is still focused on scientific investigation of such topics as the Shroud, who appeared in the original series as an expert, and crucially, is still alive and willing to talk to me. So welcome to In Research Of, Joe Nickel.
Yeah, I was just thinking as you were saying that... They described me at the time as a young skeptic.
Yes.
I thought, well, that's all those years ago. But it was in 1979, and I guess that was as good a description of me as any. I think elsewhere in the piece they described me as a private investigator and artist. You see, I used to tell Paul Kurtz I was a hack of all trades, and he would laugh and then wag his finger at me and say, no, you're a jack of all trades and master of many. So I had him fooled. But I've had a career in which I've tried to, I guess if you look back and try to find out what my main efforts were, I've tried to take some of the world's great mysteries, whatever they seem to be, and see if I could solve them. And the Shroud of Turin was certainly a challenge in that regard early on.
I imagine so. Now, before we dive into the Shroud research, can we talk a little bit about the TV show In Search Of itself? I think by season four, I know I would have been familiar with the show, but I would only have been about 10 years old at that time. How did you become familiar with the show? Had you seen any of it before they invited you?
You know, it's hard for me to remember that far back.
Sure.
Over what now seem to me rather inconsequential things, you know. That was so long ago, and I was doing so many shows that I don't have a particular memory. It's not like Leonard Nimoy walked out and he was all aglow or something. I just kind of remember some things about it. It was a lesson to me when I looked back and got a printout of the actual text and everything to see how very young I looked. But I knew, of course, who Leonard Nimoy was, but I don't remember having any particular knowledge about the show. Nor was I even drawn to the show. That's pretty much not how it works. The question I think would be how did they find obscure little old me? How did they find me? And I had already been working on the question, you know, how was this image on the Shroud of Turin, which we ought to say at some point was supposed to be the Holy Shroud. This was supposed to be the shroud in which Jesus's body was wrapped. Never mind that the Gospels don't mention such a cloth being saved, no mention at all, and nor was this shroud really compatible with the description in the Gospel of John, which describes, you see, multiple cloths, a separate cloth over the face, and the verbs tying and binding. Now, that's not the Shroud of Turin. The Shroud of Turin's a 14-foot piece of cloth that lay under the body, presumably, and then fold it over the top of the head and then lay over the top of the body. Just a simple under and over draping. And, of course, that's not according to Jewish burial practices or the Gospel of John. But it had this rather remarkable image on it. And that was the question I set to work on, was how, fake or not, in other words, how did an artist produce this such that it was said of it at every opportunity, everywhere, and this is no exception, in search of, pick that right up, that it appears to be like a photographic negative, you see?
Yeah.
And the logic was, well, if it's only, a few hundred years old, it's only known from the 1350s, and if skeptics want to say it's a fake, let them answer this question. How could an artist, a mere medieval artist, have produced a perfect photographic negative long before the invention of photography? And every time the shroud was shown, pretty much anywhere, that was the big question. And so when I started work on that question, or on the question of whether the shroud was genuine or not, I had to deal with that, what was really a question of sort of darks and lights. How did they get that way on a cloth?
You know, and I don't think they talked about it very much in the episode, but the fact that it did look better or more clear as a photographic negative, that actually became part of the miracle. In other words, instead of it being a merely faded cloth, and it, obviously the inversion of that is going to look more, you know, clear, it seems to me like they were implying that it was such a miracle that it sort of prefigured or presaged the coming of cameras. Like, that's how miraculous, you know,
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's a story to go with it. You know, the shroud had this history, and we don't go into it that much on the documentary, but they do a bit, and they mentioned that it was first showed in Lyrie, France in the 1350s, and then it came to a church and nearly burned, but the fire barely touched the image. You can just read, oh, another miracle. It was somehow protected from the fire. And how could this all be? And I know when I first started, and I was aware that skeptics like Paul Kurtz and others knew almost nothing about the shroud, because they were just dismissing it, you see, as another old fake, another bogus relic from the past and not credible. But the pro shroud people, you see, were very clever, and they were telling stories and wonders that made you sort of sit up and take notice. And one of them was that when the shroud was first photographed by a photographer named Secundo Pia in Italy, of course, in 1898, Pia tells very movingly how he was, had struggled to get the biggest camera he could find and this shroud and get it sort of working off a ladder or something and trying to photograph it. And that he was, of course, using glass plate negatives. And he tells very movingly how he was so shocked when he first saw the face of the shroud reversed on the glass plate negative. He was so shocked he almost dropped and broke the plate. And he tells very movingly about that, and I think that's true. That's exactly what happened, and it was very striking. And there's a point in which that's something, you know, that I knew I would have to deal with, this question of photo negativity.
Yeah.
And Paul Kurtz had talked maybe to the New York Times or someone, so I didn't really know him at the time, but I called him and told him that I thought we skeptics needed to be less dismissive and more knowledgeable. And you know me well enough to know that that's been a kind of a hallmark of my approach these 50 years was let's not just debunk or dismiss something. Let's try to know whereof.
Well, I find it fascinating. There's so many lines of evidence that seem like any one of them would sort of falsify the shroud as a miraculous artifact. But it reminds me of what the late James Randi used to call the unsinkable rubber duck, you know, that it...
Yes, exactly. It
just keeps coming back. No matter how many times you point out inconsistencies, it's like, yeah, but have you noticed how much it looks like our Savior? What?
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned Randi because, of course, he was a great influence on me. I owe him many, many debts. But I had called Paul Kurtz and told him that I thought, you know, we needed to be more informed and so forth, and that I proposed writing an article making some of the points that could be made, the skeptical points, like that it was contrary to Jewish burial practices and so forth. And he agreed. That was fine. And I said to him, though, I said, you know, I don't know how the image was made, but I'm working on it. Well, that was fine. And he published my first article in the Humanist magazine. And some time went on, a few months, I think, and I called him again. And I told him I could now make an image like that on the shroud, and that I knew how to make it. I could make it and show it. And he said, well, if you're convinced, I'm convinced, because he knew I was sort of the guy, you see, who was... really a nobody, but I was a nobody with some knowledge of this peculiar thing that was being advertised everywhere. I mean, it's hard to even remember when you go back to the time of the In Search Of documentary that was, the shroud was pretty much everywhere. It was on shows and in magazines and displayed and so forth, just over and over.
Yeah, we talked a little bit. Apparently, it was only pulled out of storage very rarely, and so this was around the time of one of those tours. And I don't know. I get where they opened it up. It was in Turin, and I guess hundreds of thousands of people came to see it in a very short amount of time. So it was probably, in addition to all the news crews and everything else, a hectic place to actually go to Turin then, too. So did you get the culture? I know it's been a while, but did it have sort of the same vibe as I remember King Tut's Treasures being on tour around the same time and that being constantly advertised and showing up in news segments and that sort of thing? Was it sort of that kind of a hype cycle?
Well, somewhat. Yeah. Somewhat. That was you're right that that was a big event. The Shroud was rarely brought out because it really was, faded and old and didn't need an awful lot of handling and so forth. So when they did bring it out and displayed it, people would have to come there and look at it. It wasn't on tour. It wasn't available to even go to Turin and see it. It was kept in its reliquary casket and not exhibited. But of course, there began to be photographs everywhere and talk about it everywhere. And eventually, after my second article, I forget the exact dates of that, but of course it was before this In Search Of documentary, 1979. But interesting to me, when I was looking at this, it was originally aired in November 1979, and it strikes me as really more than a coincidence that the November 1979 issue of Popular Photography magazine has my images. And they gave me space. Again, Paul Kurtz knew someone there. And pretty soon my experiments to make a quote-unquote photograph from the Middle Ages was being shown. And I was on every newsstand in America. And then before too long, with such things, you see, I was appearing now kind of as the Shroud guy, such that Carl Sagan came up to me in a conference and said, "You wrote the book on the Shroud, right?" And I thought, well, isn't that interesting that Carl Sagan would be introducing himself to me?
Yeah.
How far I've come. How far I've come. And I did have my book, The Inquest on the Shroud of Turin, and Paul Kurtz had published that. And so it was furthering that aspect of me and my work.
Now, it's interesting. You've mentioned Paul Kurtz several times, and I think people may not know your biography, but we should probably mention that you had been out of the country visiting Canada fairly recent prior to this, and Paul Kurtz...
Yes.
PsyCop only got created in 1976. So we're talking about 1979 here. And then Carl Sagan's Cosmos documentary would come out in 1980. And he was already quite famous, but that really, I think, propelled him into sort of science stardom. How did you meet Paul and how did you get involved with PsyCop?
Well, I knew who Paul Kurtz was because Paul Kurtz was organizing skeptics. He created a big conference and invited all these famous skeptics like Carl Sagan, you see. And Kurtz himself, being a humanist and being, editor of the Humanist magazine, then later started his own magazine and had his own publishing house, you see. So, as I mentioned, I introduced myself to Paul Kurtz by telephone. He never heard of me before, and telling him about the Shroud. And that's
oh wow,
exactly.
Okay,
that's exactly how I just sort of called up and And he bought the idea, okay, well, we'll do an article on the shroud then, if you'll write it. And then, oh, okay, second time, you know how to make a shroud image. Good for you. We'll publish that. And then a couple more things. He then got me, you see, in Popular Photography magazine. He knew someone there, and he knew that I had something to show, for show and tell. I could make a fake shroud, you see.
Yes.
This photo negative business, which needed a lot of explaining and showing. I could take care of that better than anyone else. And so then he called me. By then I was in graduate school, and I remember him calling me one evening and saying, if I gave you X amount of money, I think it was $1,000, which to a graduate student is like he might have said a million.
Right.
would you write a book on the Shroud of Turin for me? Well, this would be my first book, you see, and what better book could I do? There needed to be a skeptical book, didn't there, on the Shroud of Turin? And so I went ahead with it, and it was his idea for me to have a panel of experts sort of behind me, because, you know, without saying it out loud or anything, who's Joe Nickel? We need to sort of boost him a little bit. And interestingly enough, I had Dr. Michael Biden, the famous pathologist, on my committee to talk about, you know, the anatomy of Jesus as shown on the shroud. And of course, he branded it a fake right off. And I also had on my team a guy named Gerald LaRue, who, as we look at the credits for In Search Of, at the end of In Search Of, it says, "We gratefully acknowledge the assistance furnished by," and it mentions two people, one of them, Gerald LaRue, professor of religion and history, University of Southern California. And of course, he was a friend of Kurtz's, and he naturally ended up being a skeptical biblical expert. He ended up on my research team for the Shroud, and I hadn't remembered or knew, but that's maybe in part then how I got on the In Search Of.
Oh, it could be.
It makes sense.
Yeah, because LaRue is credited on several episodes. Usually, they're biblical or Bible adjacent, at any rate.
That's right.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Noah's Ark.
Yes, yes.
Something like that. He would show up, and he had written skeptically of these things, and was a good friend of mine for many years. And helped me anything I ever wanted. He was there for me. So that's an interesting connection.
It is.
But what I did, maybe I should say something about how I tried to solve this mystery of the Shroud's image.
Absolutely.
Now, the Shroud itself, you know, there were lots of things you could say, like the earliest record of the Shroud was a bishop's report in the middle of the 14th century, and he wrote to Pope Clement and said the artist that made it had confessed. So this was one of those things you suggested, that there would be a lot of things that might be telltale about the Shroud being a fake. But what was unusual was this so-called photographic negative image. And so much so, you see, that it made sense for me to have an article then on that focus alone, even, in Popular Photography magazine. My article was titled, "The Turin Shroud, fake, fact, photograph? Well, you see. And the first thing I learned in studying that image was that it was no such thing. It was not a photographic negative. And I began to invite people to, I'd say, you know, the image on the cloth, it's true, doesn't look so great, but when you photograph it, the darks and lights seem to come alive, and it looks more like a real person. Yes, that's true, I said. And however, it's not of the nature of a photographic negative, because in the reversal, you know, when you look at the reversed image, which you can only do on a photographic plate, when you look at that, yes, it looks so much better than in the image on the cloth, but it has Jesus's hair and beard as white. You see, the opposite of what you should expect if it were a photographic negative. Yes, the features looked better and all that, but it looked like a white-bearded old man. And I would occasionally make a sarcastic reference to, you know, was Jesus an albino?
What?
or something like that, you know, to point that out to people. And so it wasn't, you see, of the nature of a photograph. It just was a coincidence that it shared some features. And I struggled around for a little while. I had tried to make imprints from a human face, and I naturally used my own face. And what happens is you get grotesque wraparound distortions. You make an imprint of your face. You can put pigment on it, which I did, and press the cloth to your face and then unwrap the cloth. And, of course, it's overbroad and it looks distorted, right. And so forth. How do you get around that? And I found that, again, just by trial and error, which is kind of the way we historical detectives do so much, is we roll up our shirt sleeves and we just have an experiment or two. And I could see that this was not made from the body, in my opinion, certainly not made from the face of a real person. And that what would be necessary then, how would you remove the wraparound distortions? Well, it was pretty simple to me, being an artist. Well, we just go from a full 3D sculpture to a bas-relief, a low relief. And let's see what happens when we do that. And immediately, I had a shroud-like image.
Nice.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or, say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies?
Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
I learned, some details and so forth. I made that image by, I would take wet cloth and actually mold it to the bas-relief, working it as it slowly dried and kind of would come loose from the bas-relief. I would keep pressing down and working it with my fingers and so forth until it wanted to stay in place and be as closely formed to the relief as possible. That helps make a much better, more detailed image. And then when it's dry, and this is what I showed in the popular photography article, but it's what I'm showing on In Search Of. You see pictures of me there with a cloth wrapped around a relief, and I'm pressing with my fingers, and there are close-ups of me doing that. And that was the secret. And then the other secret was that if you were to use paint, the paint would soak into the cloth, and the shroud image was superficial. It was only on the topmost fibers of the topmost threads. How could you explain that? And again, the pro shroud people see would be at every opportunity trying to sell some mystery,
right?
Some impossibility, and then they would try to convince you that it was miraculous. And I just intuited that maybe the artist decided to use the burial spices, myrrh and aloes, which would have been powdered, you see, and that a powder, well, I could just make a sort of dauber and use a powder and a bas-relief, and it would be just as simple as making a rubbing of a gravestone.
So does that mean that the shroud itself is probably not a miracle, but that your creation is miraculous?
Yes, something like that, except the myrrh and the aloes were a mistake on my part.
Oh, no.
Of giving, well, it's quite okay. I don't mind, when I'm trying to solve a mystery, I don't mind having errors and things as I go along and having to adjust them. That's why you experiment, you see. So I was giving the forger maybe a little too much credit, that if I had been the forger, I would have used as my powder, I would have used myrrh and aloes, wouldn't I?
Because they would have been in the right region.
That's right.
Right.
This is what would have been used for Jesus' actual burial. And that would give it a touch of authenticity, you see. Why not use the burial spices? Maybe somebody would look closely in modern times and notice that and say, oh, it must be genuine. It's actually got burial spices on it. However, the artist was more of an artist than he was a modern pathologist. And he had used red ochre and vermilion tempera. And Once I knew that from Walter McCrone's microanalytical study of the shroud, they allowed him to use tape samples. You put down pieces of sticky tape on the cloth and then rip it off. And the priests standing around would shudder with, oh, horrors. Sounded like you were tearing the cloth and stuff. But you put those sticky tapes on microscope slides. And yes, I have been to McCrone's laboratory and saw his slides and everything. I was able to, you see, increasingly to be invited to places, even to some pro shroud conferences. They would invite me more than once. They would invite Joe Nickel because they thought, we'll just get this young upstart there and we'll just show, you know, how wrong he is. We'll just put him in his place. And of course, that's not how it worked out, and they did quit inviting me. But so I was all set to begin making shroud-like images, and you know, eventually then I did switch over to red ochre and vermilion. And I could make an image that, to all intents and purposes, looked very, very similar to something the shroud artist himself had made. We don't know his name, but we know that he admitted when there was an investigation, he admitted, and he may not have intended, you see, to have made a forgery. He may have just intended to make a simulation, another shroud, you know, of something to be shown. And maybe somebody misused it. It's hard to say. Maybe I should mention, over time, over history, there have been some 40 true shrouds of Jesus. Some early ones without pictures on them, but once we got the idea of putting a picture of Jesus, that too was copied. And I know you're thinking with your quick mind that at least 39 of those 40 shrouds must be fake.
Seems likely, yeah, yeah.
It seemed likely to me. And I would drop in things like that, you know, to be entertaining whenever I could.
I was going to say I think our listeners are probably very curious about what it was like behind the scenes on a shoot for In Search Of. You shot this in a very interesting place. Could you share that?
I did. I don't remember an awful lot about the details of that because, as I say, once you've done several, you know, appearances, I mean, it might be something like once you've been on one podcast, they're eventually sort of, you know, all alike.
Yeah, they got to blur together. Yep.
Yeah, you don't necessarily remember Blake Smith's very, very funny wisecracks. But I was brought to New York, and since In Search Of was produced by Alan Landsberg Productions. That needs to be known. We had the use of Alan Landsberg himself had a rather large and posh apartment, as one might imagine. And he was off somewhere doing something else, you see, very active guy, producing lots of shows. He later did shows like That's Incredible and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there, I believe, more than once in his apartment. But I know I was there for the In Search Of, and we just used his apartment. You see, you just set it up, like you would set up any photo shoot. You put the person, you know, on camera, and you put behind him something, and you figure out how you're going to shoot this, and you don't necessarily get a shot at the sink. And so that's what they did, and that's where we were. And I remember, one thing I remember about it was that they, while I was there, they put me on the phone, asked me to, you know, they wanted me to call someone that I knew about another show, because they were in the process of creating the other series, and I'm just drawing a blank on the name of that series. It might have been That's Incredible after that, but it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter, really. They were working on doing a show, not for In Search Of, I'm pretty sure, on the Amityville Horror.
Oh, yeah, that was That's Incredible, for sure, that they did that. They covered that, yep.
Okay. So I knew Barbara Cromarty, who lived in the house after the Lutzes, and I had gotten to know Barbara, and we had many wonderful talks about the house, and she had figured out that a lot of what was claimed in the book and the movie, you know, on the Amityville Horror were not true. That, for example, the windows that were supposedly ripped off and had to be repaired and so forth actually showed no such damage and had not just been repaired, but still had all the old varnish in place. And if you got up close, you could see it was none of this had happened.
Yeah.
And the door that was ripped off its hinges, no, still had the old hinges and the old varnish and so forth. But anyway, I had called her on behalf of these Alan Landsberg people because they wanted to go shoot that. And I don't remember if it was this same trip or a second trip where they were using his apartment. It just, you know, it's so inconsequential at the time. You just don't remember those kind of details. Or
right,
I don't.
Right.
Nothing earth shattering. And, but to get back to your question, you can sort of see that they fixed up a workspace for me to make one of my, I had a small bas relief, and I'm showing there how to, you know, mold it to the cloth, and I have powder and so forth. And that was about all I really remember about the shoot itself. I did not meet Leonard Nimoy. He was not there. Other guests were not there. It's typical of these shoots. You travel around, they come to you, or they bring you somewhere to their studio, maybe, or they come to your lab, and they shoot. And then they put all the different people together and have someone like Leonard Nimoy do a narration.
Mm-hmm.
But he was not there when I was there, and I have a feeling that he was scripted and did a bunch of things all, you know, all separate and at some place convenient to him.
Yeah.
Is what I think happened.
That's what we've been kind of researching.
It was a miracle. Well, it could have been a miracle.
We've been kind of following. It looks like sometimes we can tell he's on the East Coast because of, you know, things that show up in the episode. And sometimes he's on the West Coast. And but yeah, they do seem to be doing a lot of very economically sound, especially in the first season. They did a lot of things where it was clear they were shooting several episodes on the same day because his costumes weren't changing, that kind of thing. You know, we're doing a lot of deductive stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not of great importance. I note that there's picture of Father Philas in the script, and he and I sparred over the years till his death. I may have driven him to an early grave, but there's a shot of him walking along a lake shore or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he's in Chicago.
You know, but
yeah.
But I'm sure that, you know, they went to him and that was just some place he could walk out to and they could film him walking.
When we started this show, Jeb was really curious about In Search Of, because it's sort of the one of the founding documents of paranormal television. And we thought it would even be more paranormal themed than it is. It turns out that a lot of the episodes are relatively mundane. They're not that strange. They're, you know, science, weather, the earth is dangerous, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But did you feel like the producers put on screen the essentials of what you wanted to communicate? In other words, were they honest with your interview?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think even having Joe Nickel on there, you see, was a concession to this guy can make an image. And they let me make an image, you see. I don't think they really showed my image much, and I was just using a Bing Crosby bas relief for some of it, but I had other pictures and things. I just don't remember what all they showed, but they certainly seemed to me they were trying to show both sides. That they were showing that this is a mystery, this shroud. And, you know, I think fair enough. Fair enough. It was getting a lot of attention out there. And not necessarily for them to shoot it down or bring it, you know, boost it, but just to say, well, what's all the fuss about? In Search Of. And so they let the pro shroud people make their points, and they let certainly this skeptic make some points, and that they got information, you see, from Gerald LaRue, is to their credit.
Yeah, we've been very pleasantly surprised at how much more effort went into the research side of this show than modern television, or the way, at least that's how it seems to us.
Yeah, I think so.
And
I think they really had done some research. Again, Gerald LaRue, you see, they've gone to him, and he was a professor of religion and history, but also something of a skeptic, you see. And so they took some things that he said, and I guess it's he may have brought the Joe Nickel guy forward. I just don't know how they found me. I eventually was, you know, on most of the shows where the shroud, if they were going to do something with the shroud, people doing these shows would ask around, you know.
Yeah.
And they would find out, well, but we need a skeptic. They would, most of the shows want at least a token skeptic. They don't necessarily want you to totally debunk the whole thing, because viewers might say, well, why did they put that on? It's such an obvious fake. But if they put sort of both sides, as they call it, so they gave me a little bit of time, and I used it, and so I was everywhere on the shroud, And what I was ultimately, I think, maybe responsible for was I was holding up the skeptic side of the Shroud issue, speaking for science and skepticism. And that needed doing, and I did it. And all the time, my call was taken up then by more and more people, and that was, why don't we just take a little piece of cloth and carbon date it?
Yeah.
And I, everywhere I could, I began to talk about that. And I believe that they have that issue in the In Search of documentary.
Yeah, it winds up with them talking about that, you know, is that possible? And I think ultimately it does happen a few years later.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because the problem with carbon dating was that initially they rejected it because you would have to have had a big piece of cloth as big as a handkerchief, and they didn't want to damage the shroud.
Exactly.
That was at least the argument.
Right.
But eventually, with accelerator mass spectrometry, they were able to get down to a piece of cloth the size of maybe a large postage stamp, and even that could be cut in, say, thirds.
Yeah.
It would be enough. And they sent a piece of shroud cloth ultimately to three different laboratories that could do this new method of carbon dating. And they also sent them some pieces of ancient cloths like Cleopatra's mummy cloth of known date.
Right.
And so the end results were that the carbon dating gave a date range of 1260 to 1390. Well, that's just, you know, the 1350s that I mentioned as the date it first appeared, and the date of the forger's confession and so forth. Oh, that's just bracketed that. I mean,
exactly.
It couldn't have been more accurate, really.
Yeah.
Just a very, very, and all three laboratories got this aim. And it was all done double blind. No one knew, even when they did their tests, no one knew whether they were dating a piece of Cleopatra's mummy cloth or a piece of some other cloth or a piece of the shroud. They had no real way to tell. Nor would they have even wanted to know. They just were just doing these. And then the statistics were sorted out. And they were accurate. All three laboratories were accurate on all the cloths, including the shroud. It was really wonderful.
It is.
Now, the pro-shroud people, of course, have since tried to show all kinds of ways that could be wrong and in error and so forth, but it
becomes a little bit ridiculous when you've got, you know, 10 or 15 lines of disconfirmatory evidence, and then you're trying to have a special pleading for each one to explain why, but that doesn't count because this, and you know, but you know, these are, if it were just matters of faith, then people could believe what they want. But when you want to make a testable scientific claim, I think it's appropriate to do so, you know.
Yeah, and I tried to be, I tried to take my message anywhere that I could. For example, and this may strike people as a little bit odd, but I wrote an article and sent it in to Christian Life magazine, and they didn't think to ask whether I was a skeptic or a believer. They just had my article, and I spoke respectfully, you see, of Jesus and the crucifixion evidence and so forth as if I were, you know, a Christian. But that's the same way I spoke all the time. I spoke in a way that I would reveal that I was a militant skeptic, but I tried not to. So much so that when Madeline Murray O'Hare wanted me to write an article on the Shroud for American Atheist, I was not interested really in doing that because I thought, you know, I'll take hits for this. They'll start saying, well, Nickel, of course, is an atheist, so naturally he's going to be against the Shroud. But, she wanted me to write that piece, and I did.
Courtesy doesn't cost anything, and it often has a lot of rewards, right?
I think so, and I think... I think being disrespectful of, well, you know, when I investigate monsters and so forth, I'm often pretty respectful of the witnesses, even though I think the witnesses, you know, got excited or something and they didn't produce very accurate descriptions because they didn't know what they were seeing.
Right.
And so on. And I'm someone who doesn't go out of his way generally to make fun of people just for being wrong, because there, but for fortune go I. I've made mistakes, and I've, you know, had trouble getting evidence and had to piece evidence together myself many times. Traveled the world trying to find these cases that needed explaining, and then trying to find, and it wasn't always obvious in the first 5 minutes, you see.
Right.
I would have to, as with the Shroud, I would have to look further and longer and stick with it.
Well, I mentioned that my co-host, Dr. Card, couldn't make it today, but he did have a final question for you. And again, this has been a big theme on the show, which is just how has paranormal television changed? So he wanted to know, what was the experience of In Search Of like compared to more modern shows? Have things changed significantly, or are they about the same, or just in general? What is your perspective on that?
You know, I wish I could say something that would be useful and helpful. I don't know. You know, shows themselves, some show series were not very good, no matter when they were made, and some were pretty balanced. Again, whether they were old or recent. So I don't know that I'm really able. I know that my sense of things has always been pretty much that belief sold better than skepticism.
Yeah, that does seem to be true.
And that's the case way back, and that's the case today. There may have been more of a tendency to show both sides in the earlier days than there are today.
Mm.
But it may sound odd, but I don't watch a lot of modern shows anymore. I'm not doing those myself. I'm not backward looking, and I'm not in a position where I'm doing that all the time like I used to be. I used to just be doing shows and speaking at places and so forth. And now I'm just pretty much picking the cases I want to study and then working on them on my own. Well, and trying to take unsolved mysteries and solve them.
Yes. And I appreciate your continuing to work in this field because it's, I know, always been a small field. Many, many mysteries, very few people trying to actually solve them. What? So.
Yes, and you know, if you just even just look at book titles, you can just spot them from across the room almost. Here's a book, say, The World's Greatest Unsolved Mysteries. And you could just about bet that they're not interested in having Joe Nickel or somebody come and solve it. They like it being unsolved.
Exactly.
And the people buying the books want these deliciously unsolved mysteries. Ooh, I wonder what happened to Judge Crater. I wonder how they made the image on the Shroud of Turin. And you can still find books coming out recently that hype these things, even though the evidence may not show that it's unsolved. And if you dare to do, as I'm hoping to do, maybe do a book of solved mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe people are not going to be as anxious for that book. But you see, I think people that are curious. I've heard it said all my life that the surest sign of intelligence is a curious mind, and I believe that. And furthermore, people can debate how brilliant I am or am not. But I sure am curious. Boy, am I curious.
I can
prove it with my list of things that I've tried to figure out. You see, the giant Nazca drawings in Peru, the Will West case that the FBI helped me with, and many others, unsolved homicides and you name it. And I've been very, very, very curious, and I just want to, I think that if you solve a mystery, or even, you know, one might debate whether my solution is the correct one in every instance. You know, that's just my opinion, somebody might say. Okay, but I gave you a solution that I've argued and shown evidence for that's, you know, at least credible enough for me to get into a respected magazine or something, you know. So what I'm trying to do is to show that these unsolved mysteries invite us to solve them. And that's what science is about. And if I had to conclude what science is, I think science is in the business of solving mysteries.
I agree. I certainly agree. Well, I will put a link to Joe's writings and articles in the show notes. And I do encourage everybody to also check out his website at joenickel.com with two L's. And I know you're continuing to write even as we speak. So please, you can usually find Joe's work published in Skeptical Inquirer, but he does occasionally publish elsewhere. And again, there's going to be lots of stuff to read in the show notes. So please take a look at that. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today, Joe.
My pleasure. I always enjoy being on your podcast.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with Dr. Joe Nickel about his recollections of having been on the 1970s and 80s TV show In Search Of. You can find links to Joe's many works in our show notes, and his latest book, The Science of Monsters, should be out in very early in 2024. Stay tuned for more news on that. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk's theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Since 2009, people have been pouring Monster Talk into their ears to help prevent invisible stalkers, shadow people, and all sorts of metaphysical pests. If you want monsters to balk, try Monster Talk.
By Menon.
Been a Monster House presentation.